dystopians of the world. I'm Raul Guerrero, and I welcome you to the Dystopian Republic. The midday of September 12, 1999 is where today's story will begin. All was eerily tranquil, harshly lit, and horribly untidied in the shelter below the crushed caverns that led up to the now late mini-jungle and biodomed community. The countdown was at 6,934 days, 22 hours, 29 minutes, and 2 seconds, taking a back seat to the hopelessness stuffing the air. Dina was still in shock at how heartlessly Dean Jr. turned his back on her, Windsor, Eileen, Keller, Blythe, Norwood, Sydney, Francis, and Marie, as well as the brethren and sistren who entrusted him with their lives. What hurt her most of all wasn't herself or her friends having almost no hope of getting out, but it was the children who may never see a world beyond a biodome. Dina held Sydney tight and gave Francis and Marie the affection Eileen and Blythe were too hurt to give, planting a seed where reflection fused with objectivity to create its cotyledon. Not helping was how hungover Windsor, Keller, and Norwood were from a brief but intense hour and a half of drinking sherry straight from the bottle. The next 9 hours wore out a mass slumber that came out of a drive to get out that fast collapsed into a plunder that tried to drink and smoke its pain and agony away. That stretch of time unsurprisingly made an evident dent in the shelter's alcohol and tobacco supply. 6 minutes past the 22nd hour, Dina told Sydney how gravely sorry she was for the fruitless destiny she just doomed him to. Laying atop a bunk bed, Windsor cringed at a ceiling light's mocking flickers, wanting but struggling to cry at what his life had been reduced to. Eileen battled her grief by burying her eyes in book after book in the shelter's library, reading while having Francis sit on her lap. Keller locked himself in a bathroom stall and sat on the toilet, drowning in thoughts that dazed him into wishing that everyone but his loved ones pay shockingly. The first step Norwood and others took in pursuit of the shelterers' revenge on Dean was figuring out the combination for a vault that claimed to have a devastating treasure. Seasoning a pork chop with salt, basil, and rosemary, Blythe's mind played the moment she shot Malone, Sayada, and Sefton on a loop that couldn't stop. Her timid frowns, eyes turned upward as she partly fainted, plopping her rear end and face on a kitchenette floor. Dina contemptuously thanked Gregorio Jr. a lot and for everything that became nothing when the final nail was hammered into the coffin his regime now rests inside of. She was tempted to wish that she and her friends had the will to defect to Roy Sr.'s side, but asked herself who she was kidding, believing there was no way they'd be accepted. Dina said she was delusional for believing in a cause that's now nothing but a human skeleton getting more and more frail by the day. She no longer thought that the price she and her friends paid for trying to enact what the binders called for was worth it. Then a deafening pound of the coffee table made her flinch like a dog reacting to a firecracker. The perched eagle ring on the right middle finger made it unmistakable to Dina who she was on her knees before, Phoebe Biondi. Windsor broke out of his sadness and violently planted his hands and feet on the blanketed mattress when Vendeline Karlikov pounded on the bunk bed's frame like a door and told him to quit his infuriating wimp act. Alenka Angelova snapped Eileen out of her reading zone by scooping Francis off her lap like a ragdoll. At the same time, Gisler Johnson stormily emerged from the bathroom stall to Keller's right, shattered a sink mirror with an enraged punch, then noisily stomped off. Through the hacking help of Ridar Sunde, Norwood and Company opened the vault door where they discovered riches and assets beyond their wildest dreams by eons. Stomping down halls under his rage's influence, Geesley could only think of the woman who verbally battered him right where it hurt most. At a walk-in, canned tomato sauce closet opened, cans were on the floor, resting to an argument turned quarrel that ended gruesomely. Nicole and Chance Cantu clenched onto life by heaving their inhales in and screaming out their exhales while bleeding like faucets everywhere. The hatred caffeinating them kept inclinations to fear death at bay, focusing on the job they were sure Esther Ambriz was too much of a coward to finish. It was a compromising position Nicole and Chance had fallen to once before in an era when their worlds were nothing but possibilities. Eileen demanded that Alenka unhand Francis or suffer a consequence she'll certainly not like, as her baby cried over being held by someone who wasn't her mom. Blythe felt like a lady 60 years her senior, teared up and found that it was hard not to wail, whimpering for Norwood to free her from a memory that's crippled her mentally. Alenka told Eileen that her threats rang as hollow as an empty hermit crab shell, advising her to watch her next move as it could damage Francis for life. Norwood and Ridar led the snowy picking up and blowing of dollar bills and coins, and think back to the day after Gregorio Jr.'s self-declaration as Bromelia's ruler, when his troops stood on dump trucks to throw seized money at Lobotown's children and teenagers like candy. Windsor asked Vendeline how he could maintain his yellow-crossed resolve after one of its main players committed an unpardonable betrayal. Phoebe grabbed Dina by the back of her shirt, pulled her upright, and forced the table and chair out of her way, heaving her into the same hug they broke down to when they learned of Gregorio's demise. Keller imagined telling Dean Jr. that his day will come, and when it does, no one will protect him from the spirits he wantonly damned. His wish was for him and his fellow shelterers to form their own group, regardless of whether the Sajonians dig them out. Eileen called Alenka the worst kind of coward for relying on an infant's defenselessness to shield her backside from a well-deserved beating. However, Francis's increasingly over-the-top crying rended both women's hearts, making them feel disappointed in themselves for the tragedy they almost brought about. Alenka calmly handed Eileen her daughter back, recommending that they move the hell on and pretend their little spat never happened. Geesley's rageful stomp through the shelter's labyrinth of halls reached an adrenaline level where he passed out for a millisecond. That faint came in one frame and went the next, leaving him tired, lightheaded, and nauseous. On all fours, Geesley vomited the water, alcohol, and bar snacks he wolfed down, smelling rotten starch and secondhand vinegar to his revulsion. His sickly gaze reached for any sound that remotely resembled a rescue effort, but only sensed the slowness indicative of an operation to recover. Geesley was one hanging thread away from giving in to a fate that seemed inevitable, palming his forehead for taking the high life in Lobotown for granted. Vindaline reminded Windsor that the Yellow Cross wasn't Dean Jr. nor the inverse, saying that as a movement, it's as immortal as God himself. He added that no Lobo, Moretto, Valverde, Betancourt, or Malillo can ever be Bromelia, calling the betrayal that was just committed the last time its perpetrator will rest at the helm easily. Vindaline said that Dean Jr. will be in for quite a dire shock if he fought. Nothing negative would come of what he did. Windsor asked him if he really believed that, or was simply uttering BS to keep his heart from breaking into thousands of pieces. Vindaline answered that to think the Yellow Cross was this soulless, heartless machine was foolish, because it can smell, see, hear, touch, and taste the way they're able to. Windsor said that even if that was true, he's sure that shelterers like him were the ones who failed, and that the fate they now faced was punishment for that failure. For him, the worst part was knowing that kids like Sydney, Francis, and Marie may never know what the outside looks like, equating the hope spitting at him to a desert's mirage. Visibly irritated, Vindaline urged Windsor to break out of his fatalist tone, or he'll force him to, feeling it rub off on him to his embarrassment. Sensing Dina falling asleep, Phoebe jolted her out of her would-be slumber and said she had a surprise for her with a humor as good as ice cream, believing that it'll be worth the overlong walk. The jubilation Redar, Norwood, and those with them were overcome by wore off, telling them to get to bundling, rolling, and boxing. Egged on by urgency, they worked harder than they celebrated discovering the riches and realized what their desperately needed find must be used for, telling Dean that traitors never come out on top. Bundling bills like a machine, Norwood's work pace halved when something in him sensed Blythe being in grave need of his comfort. He finished the bundle he had in his hand and wasted a second running off like a man out to rescue someone in distress. Redar yelled his ask to know where Norwood was going, let out an annoyed groan, and hastily rolled the quarter roll he was working on. He jumped up and got 8 feet into his chase when a neurologic stimulus told him that Esther was in a dreadful spot. Despite one running north and the other darting south, it took a while for Redar and Norwood to get to their girls due to the directories they relied on turning out to be less than accurate. Nicole asked Esther if she's really fallen into such a pit that she's shooting people who've killed and had themselves brutalized to keep broads like her unharmed. Chance's yelling of Xochitlia plunged his cousin and their estranged friend into an album that was packed to the brim with photos and recordings so graphic that no amount of nationalist pride could prevent their nerves and stomachs from becoming a tad chilly and sour. Norwood prevented slamming his left cheek against the kitchen doorway by almost slipping onto its icy smooth floor. His determination to help Blythe crumbled when he saw her look at him like she hadn't slept in a few days, appalling him into desperately telling her that those men are gone, frying away, and can't hurt her anymore. His pleas for her to quit groveling and get over it only managed to unbreak a piece of her psyche but he was grateful for that modest step forward. Norwood carried Blythe by the back of her neck and knees to a hotel-like bedroom and tucked her to sleep, kissing her goodnight and assuring her that he'll finish preparing that entree of hers. He ran back to the kitchen, saw what he was working with, and knew exactly how to finish the recipe. Watching the pork chops bake in the oven, Norwood wondered if all the money he and others found was of any use to them if they couldn't spend it. He was also curious about how the shelter still had power and running water after the collapses, and whether it'd be better if he and his fellow shelterers make the most of their appalling situation. Tossing and turning like an upset pancake, Blythe's mind was consumed by how brief the race to escape the shelter wound up being. Seeing the countdown for the first time was that bite that injected hope, urgency, and determination into her and her fellow shelterers. The administrators relied on the shelter's directories to access its exit points, discovering that Dean's collapses had crushed the caverns ahead of them. What should have been a dimly lit yet unobstructed void was now a lightless pile of heavily compressed rock. The administrators' efforts to break through the block resulted in broken machinery, minor injuries, and spirits broken by the futility of said efforts. It became obvious to them that no drills or claws out of the shelter and through the caverns would suffice in rising from the now demolished dome or the nature inconsistently layering over it. The administrators found it miraculous and a tad odd that Dean's collapses didn't crush them or their shelterers upon impact. Nevertheless, their despair spread throughout the shelter like an airborne virus, turning it into a petri dish for a childishly scribbled up grief. Since that hopelessness first broke out, none of the shelterers had heard from or seen any sign of the administrators. Blythe initially thought that fact was due to an unscheduled emergency meeting that immediately followed the unfortunate discovery. But now that the administrators have been out of sight for hours, her concern for their well-being grew, because she and her shelterers saw them as their only remaining lifeline. Blythe kept the impulse to completely break down at bay by telling herself that the people who ran the shelter will prevail and not seek relief through suicide. Her mental exhaustion gradually submerged her in a sleep that mumbled her iniquitous giggling. Eileen and Alenka read that the biodome was a collaborative project between Habsburgo Brumel College and the University of the Capital. Both institutions aspired to create an ecosystem that could sustain itself and where plant and animal life would flourish. Eileen and Alenka continued reading, and what they learned next explained how the biodome found itself in the Yellow Cross's hands to their utter disbelief. Phoebe dragged Dina into her mini-suite, pulled a briefcase from under her bed, and button-pressed it open to reveal a camera and videotape. She wanted to show her a movie that'll bring her back to the light Gregorio blessed them, their friends, and all who lived in Lobotown during its heyday. Phoebe slipped and pressed the tape into the camera she connected to the TV, playing a movie that regressed Dina's mind to a brighter past. Dated September 17th, 1989, it began with Dean Sr. telling viewers that today's the day her sweet little angel becomes a princess of God's kingdom. He films Dean Jr. looking as sharp as ever, mostly pretending to be excited about his little sister's ceremony and Turnbull being unable to wait for the party afterwards. Dean Sr. filmed his workers combing Dina's hair, doing her makeup, and helping her put her holy white dress, lace wristbands, stockings, and flats on. Joyce topped her daughter's attire off with a silk headband that tied into a horned crossed bow at its center, describing it as her baby's offering to their yellow crossed ancestors. Asked if she was ready, Dina called that a silly question and the coming ceremony 7+ years in the making. Suddenly, much of the power went out, stopping everything that was going on dead in their tracks, but the lights were still on in one room. The administrators inside it were ready to unleash their cry for help, agreeing that Dean Jr. was a scared little B-word boy for thinking that the S he pulled would silence them for good, because unbeknownst to him, they've made a number of additions to the shelter. Furthermore, they were over 3 years into their plan to double-cross him and join an entity that transcended the left and right. The administrators were sick and tired of living like birds and on their butts, doing nothing but eat, drink, play, and sleep, having a need to be productive that remained unfulfilled for too long. They knew that in Dean's eyes, they were tainted, and thus they believed that him betraying them was inevitable. Besides, the administrators grew disillusioned with the Yellow Cross cause and saw it as a senile person who's close to 4 years into their dementia. Their main reason for staying aligned with Dean was so that they would have enough resources to make the necessary preparations for the day their relationship with him ends. Through typing, the administrators instructed their main computer to put the crying help protocol into play. Several shrubs surrounded the biodome's vicinity, hiding the circular bulbs that bloomed out of the ground like flowers to simultaneously shoot invisible lights at the skyway above. In a courtyard apartment in Las Grandes Cascadas, a woman with pruny hands was fixing her pillow to make sitting on her chair more comfortable. She sat down to watch the news and learned of the collapses near Hazalacqua, calling the late biodome's presumably deceased inhabitants poor sods. The woman asked what an old granny like herself could have done to help them, then heard the distress signal. She knew her encrypted computer would flash out right on cue. She told herself to wait a minute because the shelterers were never in any real danger and that Dean played right into her hands. The woman said that if help was what they wanted, that'll be what they'll get, declaring that a shelter has been reborn. News outlets covering the collapses live felt shaking coming from near where they occurred, scaring them into running for cover under tables or at doorways as the shakes got stronger and stronger. A cylindrical tube rose out of the earth, how a rocket would blast off, having the shelter in its vicinity entirely within its inner radius. It then partly closed from atop its height to form two more radii, the innermost one swirling a black laser that fired downward. The blast vaporized the mini jungle on contact and slowly but surely made the biodome evaporate like water. It effortlessly turned the caverns and earth around them to vapor, but stopped short of touching the shelter. The cylinder then rolled back into the earth, causing another series of violent shakes to rock the Sajonian Islands. All the while, the shelterers were made unconscious by a sedative gas that engulfed the shelter in a cloud as vaporous as steam from a sauna. Only the administrators weren't affected thanks to the gas masks they wore to avoid breathing in the mist. The second the cylinder was back under the ground was when the shaking ceased, prompting news reporters to dart to the newly formed crater and Sajonian authorities to round them up. Cameras and tape recorders were confiscated, thrown to the ground, and stomped on until they were little more than broken pieces of trash. Sajonian militants arrested reporters, heaved them into military vans, and began taking them to jails across the island chain. Once all the media was gone, Sajonian fire brigades and first responders made their way down the crater and onto the shelter's topmost roofs. They used the only drills powerful enough to cut the iron carbon alloy used to make it all but impervious to implosion. The two crews raided the shelter, picked up the shelterers like children, and got them out with the help of the medevac team that was close behind them from the start. They couldn't help but wince with sympathy and let sorrow shake in their breaths, noticing how peaceful Dina, Windsor, Eileen, Keller, Norwood, Blythe, Phoebe, Vendeline, Geesley, Alenka, Esther, and Radar looked, and the horrendous shapes Nicole and Chance were in. On December 24th, a lonely blue love made sure that no part of Dean Jr.'s fortress wasn't able to hear a tune that's aged like a fine wine. His lesser subordinates built gingerbread houses and people got stuffed on ham, rotisserie chicken, sugar cookies, and pecan pie, danced and sang along with the song, played with toy train sets, beheld the dense decorations all around, and wrapped presents for themselves and each other. Dean's more essential servants took turns celebrating Christmas and being on high alert for developments involving their group or its enemies. He had a particular interest in knowing what's become of the Hizalakwa situation, as the last piece of news he received was that the late dome had been vaporized by a mammoth cylindrical tube. Dean couldn't confirm or dispel rumors that the Sajonians rescued the shelters and were holding them somewhere else. After the collapses, he ordered Sajonian Islands President Newton Zhang to leave the cohort to die like primitives, warning him that he'll have hell to pay if he violates that order. Dean wanted to believe that the Sajonians sped up the dying process and would have been okay with that, but feared that a mutiny was afoot. He wasn't aware that they built a cylindrical tube, much less one so earth-shaking. Figuring out how they secured the resources to construct it without his help, that crafted the high possibility that Newton's long-standing loyalty to the Yellow Cross was a selfish front to make himself and his people the ones with all the world's power. An incoming message from a robotic voice told Dean that he was partly right to think that the Sajonians want the Earth for themselves and them only. Its voice morphed into the one Newton had as he called his former leader one that never was in the first place. He asked Dean if he really thought the Sajonians would ever be unconditionally loyal to a Caucasian ogre like Gregorio Jr., calling him a haughty pig for thinking so. Newton said he's unafraid of some Yellow Cross remnant, adding that he now has access to riches that'll make the Sajonian Islands a power on the world stage. Dean countered by asking him what good his strength will do if the global community knocks the door to his island chain down like an angry mob chasing after a mad scientist's monster. Newton warned what remained of the Yellow Cross to stay out of his way, or he'll reveal the coordinates to their Antarctic fortress to the whole world. Dean yelled that he had no clue where he fled to after the Civil War, calling his threat complete and utter bull. Newton responded to his bluff by voicing out the fortress's coordinates one number at a time, asking him if he guessed right. Dean refused to answer and thanked goodness that the position numbered out wasn't right on his hideout, but was close enough to make it partly visible, convincing him that a collusion was in order. Newton called that a joke if he ever heard one, and said he and his people will still go after his group, as well as Upton Jr.'s, and that nothing will change their minds. His offer to Dean was that he'll try to keep this conflict between them, but he'll involve the global community if so much as a single retaliatory fathom comes his way. Newton told the Yellow Cross remnants to accept the reality that this Earth was his now and will belong to his order for the remainder of time. And since he's in the Christmas spirit like everybody else, he'd like to introduce the newest members of his Zashonian people, the cohort Dean and his subordinates betrayed so horribly. Dina said hello to her quote-unquote big brother, asking him if he missed her Windsor, Eileen, Keller, Norwood, Blythe, Phoebe, Vendeline, Geesley, Alenka, Esther, Radar, Nicole, Chance, or the others he tried to entomb alive. Dean was so white in the face that it was impossible for him to speak, enticing Newton to tell him that it was high time for his world to collapse the way he tried to race the Shelterers into the ground. That said, both leaders weren't aware that Upton Jr. had moles in their ranks, all of whom were hell-bent on divulging to him the exchange word for word. Dean broke the news to Dina, Windsor, Eileen, Keller, Norwood, and Blythe that BS2 want their behinds, and that reminded Vendeline, Geesley, Alenka, Esther, Radar, Nicole, and Chance that they're war criminals in the eyes of the Bromelian government. His point was that the Shelterers may no longer be many feet under, but that definitely didn't mean they were free to live life normally. Dean praised Newton for nicely guessing his fortress's coordinates, but added that pinpointing its location was one matter, and actually traveling to it will be a whole different beast. He said that the Zashonians may know their way through the tropics, but doubted that their bodies can handle a cold that exists nowhere else on Earth. Newton replied that unlike Dean, he's no foolhardy pighead and has his offer to rely on to buy him enough time to build the necessary infrastructure for a successful trek through the White Continent. In Ireland, south of Majuro Marshall Islands, Selvdium was sunshiny, serene, magnificent, and where the Zashonian Islands had its sole military base abroad. Heavy jungle cloaked the facility in a sprightly green that even the healthiest eyes would find disorientating. Under that cloak was a military base akin to the one Roy Sr. had, which Newton knew how to mimic for reasons that go back to the days of the Civil War. Inside the base, the Rusalka 6, Lobotown 6, and recovering Cantu 2 were united and starving for vengeance. they and Newton contacted Dinas 1 and made mostly in Turnbull listen to the whole thing without the ability to talk back. Whatever ill will Esther had for Nicole and Chance and the animosity that existed in the inverse was now gone, and so was the hatred the allies around them had towards one another, or so they all thought. Newton told Dean that he was right to have Mosley and Turnbull prepare for a breach of their hideaway, chuckling that he and his hench people know where it is. He advised the Malil brothers to practice waiting for the end and begging for mercy, because that's all they'll be doing once he's through with them. As powerless as Dean thought he was at that moment, Mosley and Turnbull felt anything but, intending to fight to the bitter end. On a secure lined phone, Newton watched over Claire playing dolls with three of his houseworkers in the room directly across from him. His daughter was his pride, joy, and reason for living, not knowing what he'd do if danger finds its way to her. Newton said that the Rusalka 6, Lobotown 6, and Cantu 2 will forever be known as the Shelter Reborn, an alliance that'll ensure his victory over the world's global powers. His parting message for Dean, Mosley, and Turnbull was that they and many of their minions won't live to see him prevail, and to look at that as a blessing if they will. After the call ended, Dina asked Newton if he knew who Candida, Catalino VI, Yamile, Regulo, Verinia, and Lisandro were and how they're doing. That had the Lobotown 6 raising their eyebrows, demanding to know who the hell those 6 were and why the Rusalka 6 cared so much about them. Newton regretted informing Dina that Candida, Catalino VI, Yamile, Regulo, Verinia, and Lisandro hadn't fared much better and were in deep, deep water as of them talking. She asked him what he meant by that, irking him into repeating what he said, leaving it at that, and saying it's better she doesn't know the details. Unable to make Newton budge on his refusal, Dina couldn't believe how much of a fool she was for setting Candida up to be taken away by Dean, but didn't regret murdering Flavio Jr. or hurting Manola. Had she seen her brother's betrayal coming, she wouldn't have shown the red binders to her friends, but found that easy for her to say now that she's on his side no longer. Dina's feeling that she owed Candida an apology was what Windsor, Eileen, Keller, Norwood, and Blythe felt toward Catalino VI, Yamile, Regulo, Lisandro, and Verinia, respectively. All 6 agreed that in due time, the 12 of them will be one again, making Newton give that agreement a squint that disliked what it heard. The Lobotown 6 also didn't care much for what the Rusalka 6 set out to do, but did like that the clique they groomed for years was molding another, looking at that as the moment a mother bird watches her chicks successfully fly off the nest for the first time. Newton's civilian contacts kept him up to date with the happenings in Bromelia, and what he learned of the Maronbury 6 was shocking, to say the least. He understood that there wasn't much he could do to sway the Rusalka 6 into reconsidering their shared desire. Newton didn't hold that against them, but was afraid that they'll have to come to their senses the hard way and won't be the reason why. He declared that where those under him stood politically was irrelevant, and that a new era had begun, hoping that Dean, Upton, and Rounce the First have a Merry Christmas, because they won't have a Happy New Year. Ulrich Jr. spent his New Year's Eve with Demi and Cadence, who were in Bromelia for winter break. Before meeting in person, he saw the girls as two chicks he could have a good time with, and they viewed him as a man who could shower them with gifts. But after spending hours together, those three realized that the taboos their union broke was secondary to the political power they so craved. Seconds into the new millennium, Ulred received a call from Dean dispatching him to run for president of Bromelia. That dispatch was his order to take his rule over Las Grandes Cascadas federal, a reign so dark, grim, and cold that people either worshipped or wanted him dead. Dean had to have Ulred be president because only that could get him out of the corner Newton got him in. Plus, it could convince the National Identity Union that distancing themselves from the Yellow Cross wasn't necessary. Dean was surprised the far-right faction didn't embrace its roots overtly even after one of their own became the governor of a province that was arguably Bromelia's most liberal in 1996. Ulred was cognizant of how the ex-shelterers were betrayed, dreading the hell Newton will have the so-called shelter reborn raise. On January 2nd, 2000, he declared his candidacy to seek the Bromelian People's Party nomination for president of Bromelia. Ulred's mission was to evict the corrupt liberal freaks who've deconstructed the reconstruction their nation underwent after the Civil War. His speech got politicians like Romulo ready to stand with him, appreciating that the silent part wasn't said out loud as Ulred Sr. would have liked it. Ulred vowed to make 2000 a year round we'll never forget, and one that'll turn 1998 and 1999 into afterthoughts. And as fate would have it, his election bid would rapidly intensify the strength of an eyewall's already powerful stationary spin over Bromelia. And that was a shelter reborn. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.